Okay, so you want to go get set up. And by the way, you should mention who comes.
All right.
Yep.
It's June 29th, 2017. We are here today talking about Ghana with Michael and Professor Joseph.
Well, let me begin with the significance of Ghana, which was the first tropical African country to become independent in March of 1957. And Ghana was led for several years until he was overthrown by one of the principal nationalist leaders in Africa, but not just in Africa. He was one of the leaders of significance as a Pan-African leader, but also as a, you know, what came to be called the Third World, and namely Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Ghana is also significant because despite the political cycles that it has experienced, the country has never had a any significant movement that threatened its territorial integrity, and it has been able to maintain a very high level of national consciousness, national awareness within Africa. All right. I had the opportunity to travel to Ghana on a number of occasions during the late 1970s when I was teaching at the University of Ibadan. I had a close friend from my Oxford years, and gonna have to recollect his name, Bafur, and I'll have to get Bafur's full name, whom I visited on a number of occasions in Accra. And this was a period of military government in Ghana. Ghana went through a series of military government, and it was also a period in which, like Nigeria, Ghana was going through a process leading to the restoration of a civilian system, a constitutional civilian system. That system did not last very long. It was overthrown by Jerry Rawlings, who in fact had, you know, conducted an initial coup. You will get all of these dates. Michael will know what those dates are, all those dates. But Rawlings had returned, and when he returned now with a commitment to govern the country and transform the country in a number of directions. So that is the system under Jerry Rawlings and the PNDC that persisted throughout the 1980s. Rawlings, who self-identified as a socialist at that time, and whose government had a very radical posture, was a regime that was very critical of not only the former colonial systems, but also very critical of the United States. There was an important turnaround in Ghana, and again, we'll get all of those dates right, and the first major turnaround in Ghana had to do with its political economy, because the regime turned to the Soviet Union to get assistance and to be brought into the same sphere as other countries with which the Soviet Union had a very strong relationship. Cuba comes to mind, in which the Soviet Union would be prepared to provide a great deal of economic assistance. Well, it turns out that the Soviet government was itself facing its own economic strains and was not prepared to take on Ghana in that regard. So, Ghana was forced to turn to the international financial institutions, such as the World Bank and others, and to negotiate a liberalizing process, economic liberalization process. Right? So in the case of Ghana, economic liberalization was real well ahead of the political liberalization. I mean, if anything, it gave the regime a new lease in life, because those international institutions did not require any political changes in Ghana and other countries at the time in order to enter into these kinds of relationships. And so the regime also was able to bring on board some, senior economists to help with that policy. The movement emerged as the decade wore on, in opposition to the government, in opposition to military rule, one of the notable leaders of that movement, Professor Edu Boahen, who was a well-known Ghanaian historian. And so he was a figure both in terms of that period of struggle against the regime, the military regime, but also Edu Boahen once the transition occurred, he was he came forward as the first opposition leading. There were other candidates, but he was the leading opposition candidate to Rawlings in the 1992 elections. All right. Let me shift over to saying a few things about the Carter Center, and we're gonna have a few of these sessions on Ghana, because there is just quite a bit to record, to re-examine, and I will be able to do so, more closely looking at some of the documents of the period. The I will use the Ghanaian case to point out that that President Carter's approach in support of his priorities, first was peace. Second, I would say, was human rights. Third was development policies, and which, you know, in the case of countries like Ghana, evolved to include both, you know, disease eradication, such as guinea worm, and also agricultural development, in this case, increasing maize production. Democracy as such, I really have to be just, you know, a little careful in how I really, you know, say this, because we didn't really have discussions of this nature at the Carter Center. It was basically, you know, we're engaging, here are some issues, you went ahead and you worked on it. We didn't sit down, there wasn't, you know, sitting around a table with President Carter and working out what our priorities happen to be. That was not the modus operandi. You know, if there was a point in which you strayed too far, well, then, you know, and I have, you know, you'll get a little note from him, or you'll get, he'll minute on a document it was sent to you. So that was the, you know, the usual way of making sure that, you know, that people working closely with him. But we had a, you know, wide array of autonomy of, you know, in deciding the shape of the program. But there was, you know, the sense that, you know, his particular commitments and the commitments of people, you know, who worked with him were not exactly in sync. So I was really coming to, you know, some of these engagements as a much more forthright supporter of democratic transitions. I mean, except in very, extreme circumstances, you know, would I, you know, feel, well, I wouldn't use the word accommodating. I'd be willing to accommodate, you know, autocratic, authoritarian, you know, systems in particular contexts. I would recognize that. But I certainly did not see any long-term exercise of authoritarian power as being legitimate. And certainly, you know, I brought, you know, those views to the Ghana engagement. So I had my clear, you know, feelings, personal feelings and attitudes about, you know, the regime, the military regime, autocratic regime, like any of the regimes. And, you know, those views are, you know, are clearly available in our publications, Africa Demos and other things of the time. So let me get to the Ghana, and I know you found a date for when we made that 1989 visit to Ghana, so we'll have the exact date of that visit, and we, you know, so a team, you know, led by President Carter arrived, you know, for these meetings. You know, Carter had his agenda. So high on his agenda was the you know, disease eradication, you know, programs, and especially guinea worm, and what was then called Global 2000, I believe, and subsequently it became Sasakawa Global 2000. Because a lot of the funding was put up by this Japanese entrepreneur, Sasakawa. And, you know, I remember one particular meeting, you know, as part of that visit. And this was going to be a meeting with Rawlings himself. It's never happened before, so I'm mentioning it here, because this was still early in the life of the Carter Center, and very early in this model, which we'll get a chance to talk some more, of where you had a half dozen university professors, we were all at that time at Emory University, and some in the law school, most of us in faculties in the social sciences at Emory University, you know, playing this kind of a role. It's a very, very unique situation to be given that, you know, that kind of authority. You know, it's hard to think of an equivalent of it. So anyway, but this was very early. It's 1989, but I always remember this this meeting where, and remember, this is a military regime. This is a autocratic military regime that's been in power for several years, where people have been executed, driven into exile, independent views, repressed, people are, by that time it wasn't a sort of, it's not like, say, the Ethiopian situation. It wasn't a case of harsh repression at that time, because again, this is a regime that is now in negotiations with international institutions, pursuing economic liberalization strategies. So there's an atmosphere of, things being loosened up, but still the regime was very, very firmly in control, and had no plan to be, sharing power or allowing an open process. It was just not on the agenda. It's not that people won't call of it, and the regime controlled, most of the major media instruments, okay? And that was the context. But anyway, so this meeting, I remember it very clearly because I was there with, the team, and we're, going into this meeting with Rawlings and with his team, and this is where, I don't know how it actually come about, but as I was coming up to enter the meeting, the doors were closed. So I was now outside. And, it was, and there was, Rawlings and his men around, and the meeting is taking place inside. Like I said, can't think of another circumstance, because usually, once we go in there in a team, I'm with President Carter, I'm with him. So, you just go in a sort of, entourage, whoever, and he's already worked out. But anyway, so it's kind of a strange situation. And then it didn't take long. I mean, but a few minutes later, the doors opened and I was ushered in. So what had happened was, President Carter and Mrs. Carter usually, and that's another thing we could talk about if we go along, what important role that, she played. But they had already entered it, and, they looked around and said, sort of like, where's Richard? And then they have to say, and they had to open the doors and let me back in. But it does give you a little sense now of the, a discomfort, on the part of Rawlings and his close affiliates, I wouldn't know. I mean, what they would have known about me before that date, right? But obviously, it was very clear that they were very much aware, and especially given the fact that they're dealing with an opposition now, and to them, what they would have learned about me would seem to put me more in the camp of the opposition than in that of the loyalists to the regime, all right? But that was it then, and when we talk later on, we could talk about how those tensions have worked themselves out. And, and even myself learning recently from John Stremlau, how much Rawlings himself personally internalized, this guy. I sat in the meeting. I didn't contribute to the meeting. I listened. The meeting was largely, President Carter talking about his, I said his prime things, the guinea worm and the agricultural program. Now, what is important about that visit was that after the center was there, and I can't remember where they were going on to, I stayed on in Ghana for a few days. So now I stayed on in Ghana, you can say basically on the Richard Joseph / African governance agenda. But remember, I'm now operating under the, you know, the mantle of the Carter Center, you know, which provided a certain amount of protection, right? Because, you know, since the regime is building a relationship with Jimmy Carter and vice versa, well, they don't want anything, you know, disruptive to be entering in. And so I went around and I conducted my own conversations as I would normally do if I were arriving in any countries to find out what's going on. So I was really meeting, you know, we dig up the name, Anan, I think he was, who headed up this commission that was supposed to oversee elections and so on. And I would go in and talk to them and ask them a lot of questions. What are they doing? What are they thinking? What are their plans? And remember, 89 now, we're really talking about a time when, you know, changes are already occurring. You know, we already have national conferences, you know, taking place in other countries like Benin and so on. So the idea of, you know, waves of change taking place. And this regime is now very guarded about it. But I remember, so I was able to go and ask him questions, you know, but in my own mind, I'm really making an assessment. And my basic assessment was, you know, they're not serious. This is all, you know, later on I gave it a term, which is democratic presentability. In other words, they are only interested in, satisfying the sort of what we call the international community to the limited extent possible. Right? So it really gave a sense of it. And your other reports that we were able to read. So so during that period, 89 to 92 now, we have already made that that connection. The Carter Center is building up. Jimmy Carter had a very strong, he liked Jerry Rawlings. And, you know, on a number of occasions he would say things like, you know, these are the kinds of leaders, you know, he really admires, all right? And what he would get from me is, you know, I don't share that admiration. I never came right out and, you know, do so, but he would, you know, be very much aware of it. I remember, I think there was one occasion when he wanted to, because Rawlings now, in terms of what I tell was Carter's priorities, in terms of the health and the agricultural programs, is now Rawlings would, you know, really see that from his standpoint, because Rawlings, he was an autocrat, but he had a very strong social commitment, right? So Rawlings was willing to, to work actively with Carter on these programs because it was beneficial to him. You know, Carter's, you know, had a, you know, very high reputation in Africa. And he could seize on to things and so on. And Rawlings is a populist. He wasn't any kind of, he didn't really have any kind of full-blown socialist ideology and so on. He was a radical, he was a populist, right? He was, you know, anti-Western in terms of Western democracy and so on. All right, so during that period now, the 89 to 92 period, you have agitations, you know, increasing in the country, the Rawlings regime being forced to give ground, you know, step by step, you know, finally you have a constitutional process, and then that constitutional process leading to the return of a multi-party system and with elections coming up, right? But all in a context in which this radical regime, which had, and I'll say a couple of things about Ghana. And Ghana is a very unique country, and of course it's a country, closely attached to, the same country I'm very closely attached to, obviously Nigeria, because of all the work I've done there. I'm closely attached to Cameroon because that's where I did my basic work. But, the country that, in terms of, I have to be so careful what I say. But anyway, I'm a Ghanophile. I love Ghana. I love the Ghanaian people. I love the Ghana culture. A lot of things I like about Ghana. During that period, that Ghana is sort of returning to what many of us saw as its historic mission, that seeing Ghana's historic mission to be a leader as a democratic leader in Africa, not a leader in terms of an autocratic system, no matter what it does. All right, and so that Ghana was returning to it, and so my work. And again, we'll see all the details at the Carter Center, was really establishing, building relationships, with some of that community. Of course, being very careful, relating also to the regime figures. But for example, the current Atta, what is the current president, prime minister or president of Ghana? I met him when he was one of the, a lawyer, part of that opposition force in Ghana during that period. So where do I want to end this? That the Carter Center's played a very significant role in this process of Ghana's transition to a constitutional democracy, which went through different stages. It was a very iterative state process. It wasn't as if, even in Zambia, which we could compare it to, where there was, that was a weakening regime under Kaunda. And so once the process started, Kaunda just couldn't stand in the way. It was just moving along. That was not the case in Ghana. The regime was still well entrenched. Oh, I know the other thing I wasn't going to say about the certain duality of Ghana. And one of the dualities, for example, had to do with the Ghanaian military. And Ghana had, like Zambia too, professional military force, and Ghanaians, military soldiers have played a very important role in terms of peacekeeping missions internationally. And later on, for example, the Ghanaians' involvement in Liberia, the Ghanaians were just very highly professional. And that was maintained under Rawlings, right? But yet, Rawlings also had his own special security military contingents. So there was this duality within Ghana that they were able to maintain. And again, one important part of the transition is how, Ghana was able to sort of regularize all of those, sort of units and contingents that they had, and their contingents and units was really there for the protection of the regime. Okay, and we were really operating in that kind of a context. But I'm going to stop because it turns out that in Ghana, I played personally. There are places in which I was there, the Carter Center, but Ghana was one of the countries where I was able to play a real personal role because, as I mentioned, that I was, I was so strongly committed to a democratic transition in Ghana. And really understanding what that meant. And being able to relate to the opposition forces. And obviously, this is a military regime, it has security, so they would have been fully aware of meetings I was having, conversations that were taking place, and so on and so forth. Right? So I was operating in that kind of a context. And then finally, you know, when once the elections came about in 1992, and in fact, what we normally, in the way that these monitoring missions were set up, was we normally would be doing it in association with other organizations. In this case, it was the National Democratic Institute, and we would look for President Carter would, you know, be the person sort of chairing this operation, but he would also bring in someone else to sort of co-chair with him, all right? And, you know, with that kind of a setup, and sometimes it would be a European leader, other leaders, you know, from Africa, but he would find somebody else with a certain international stature who could be sort of co-chair that operation. Well, in this case, two things happened in terms of Ghana. One, he wasn't able to take part, you know, be present for the elections in 1992. And second, the people we reached out to, I mean, I'm just reading by Sridath Rampal, who is a former Secretary General of the Commonwealth. I remember that he was one of the people that we reached out to. But anyway, we had identified a few people, but we couldn't. None of the people that we reached out to were available for that, to Ghana things. And President Carter at that time, when we were already putting it in place, when we were meeting, and he just said to me, "Why don't you do it?" All right. And so if you could, you know, bear in mind what I've told you, starting from that 1989 visit to Ghana. So here was, I had the role, you know, of course I'm directing the African Governance Program. I am now responsible for the Carter Center monitoring mission, because we have a group along with the others, and I sort of have sort of executive responsibility for that. But also, because we did not have either President Carter or another international figure, I was now having to play that role of negotiating some of the contentions that emerged. Okay? All right. So I'll stop there, and over to you, Michael.
Okay, great. Thanks. That was very informative. I have several questions regarding like specific things that the Carter Center might have done. Mm-hmm. I know you didn't really touch on specific interventions yet, so feel free to just skip ahead. I have several questions, so okay. Don't feel the need to answer them. First off, I know in the late 80s, I mean, you have Professor Boahen and not to mention Rawling himself are like decrying this culture of silence within Ghana. My first question is, what steps, if any, did the Carter Center take to reform the culture of silence, especially, you know, before these 92 elections?
Okay, so we're going to look at a lot of specifics. As the Carter Center becomes involved, and it is very clear to the leaders and the regime, right, that once they agreed to having the Carter Center involved, that there will have to be a loosening up of the system. It just the two go together, right? It's also the case that we would, advocate. I mean, there'd be other organizations doing so, but you know, we would lend our voice to that. We would advocate for greater freedom of the media, just basic freedoms, greater freedom of movement, you know. So we wouldn't directly address something like the culture of silence, which, you know, really was, you know, that term, what it meant to Ghanaians and the role that Professor Boahen played in coming out and challenging it, right? But we would contribute to the, before the elections, to the improvement in terms of, you know, basic freedoms, in terms of the atmosphere, all right? Now, I don't know if we could get hold of it, but, you know, I I mean, I remember in particular, sometime before the actual elections, being interviewed on Ghanaian television, right, and being pretty, being quite explicit, because I was just, I was speaking, I was involved in that role, but I was speaking as somebody who was an advocate for democratic progress in Africa. But I remember, there was an interview on television, and I will talk about another, a couple of other media encounters that I had, but that would have sent a very, very clear message to the government as to where I was coming from, which was that, I had no sympathy for a lot of the obfuscations about the process that, that Ghana, was entitled to have, a genuine, open, free and fair electoral process and so on. So they, in a number of ways, the consequence of us being there was contributing to this opening up of the system. And we'll talk about it in some more specific ways, relations with the Electoral Commission and so on. Yeah, later on.
Okay, near the end of your interview, you mentioned the military in Ghana, how much of a role it plays there.
Right.
And I know that, like, Rawlings and the PNDC, they rely heavily on the military for state control, and in turn, the military plays a large role in the government.
Right.
So, how did you combat the outsized influence of the military on political affairs? It seems that's something that's very unique to Ghana, specifically.
Yeah, well, I want to be very clear, and this is why I mentioned, we had nothing to do with the professional Ghanaian military as such. Nothing whatsoever to do with them. In the case of Zambia, I know we actually had some meetings with some of the leadership, but that never took place, right? I was very much aware of, the role of these military contingents. In fact, I'm just remembering, there was, we'd have to get the dates clear. There was the NDI, National Democratic Institute, had done pre-election sort of survey in Ghana, and which was very explicit about a lot of the deficiencies in Ghana they're talking about. And, of course, the regime was very upset about this because, it contradicted the kind of image they were trying to put forward. And this was very explicit about what Ghana really was at that time. We're talking about, well into, the process 1991, in terms of the changes taking place. And the regime was still, it hadn't made that real clear commitment to, an open, democratic, competitive process, right? And I remember that coming into Ghana and following up that report with questions of my own, right? And which, of course, was extremely, disturbing to, the people I was talking to, right? Because here you have a, something that was really challenging, the view that the regime was trying to put forward. And I'm asking questions just based on that. So this was, there was, discomfort and disquiet. In most other cases, quite frankly, if it wasn't for President Carter and the Carter Center, I would not have been allowed to continue doing my work in Ghana. I mean, they would just say, but I was able to. So. But to get to your question, the regime, which was a military regime, right, and which had carried out coups and which had, had to really maintain that real strong hand and so on, And then there was the person that, you know, I met, which was sort of the right-hand man of Rawlings, which was his chief national security person. But he had a broader role. He was both national security, so he would have had all of the, you know, secret services and special military contingents sort of reporting to him. But he also played a more political strategic role, because the image, they really saw themselves as revolutionaries. You know, this was their self, you know, conception of themselves, right? But his name is, and his name will come up in your documentation, his name is Kojo Chikata, all right? He has a younger brother who also got, you know, I think in terms of dealing with petroleum and so on industries. But anyway, so you don't confuse it to the Chachu. But anyway, Chikata was really the strong man behind Rawlings. And so, you know, I had meetings with him. Very, very, very intelligent man, very brilliant man. You know, and you'll have conversations with him. I was very clear about who he was. And, you know, he was a very intelligent man, so he was very clear about who I was. But later on, we'll talk about, you know, when, you know, and this all came into play after the elections, because after the elections, this was a very critical period, having to do with the regime and the fact of, you know, the opposition views about how that regime played. And I found myself for a period of maybe, I don't know, it could have been no more than a week, very much being at the center of, you know, what happens now and, you know, and how to keep this thing from going off the rails, when the opposition was just, you know, because Rawlings had really was conducting an election in a context in which the regime was still fully in control of all of the equipment. So we're carrying out an election in that kind of a context, right? So, so again, it's just, there was no, sort of confrontations, you know, that we had, but it was a case of, having to work, with individuals who left up to them, we would not be doing what we were doing. That's simply that, right?
Okay, I have one slightly broader question.
Okay.
And this is the transition to constitutional democracy that started in the late 80s and continued as the Carter Center got involved in Ghana. How optimistic were people about the long-term prospects of multi-party democracy?
At that time?
Yeah.
I think, again, it's really something. I worked for 6 years with Jimmy Carter, but, you know, we never had those kinds of conversations. I mean, you would think that, you know, because it was, you know, it was really operational, where we're operating and so on. I mean, there were circumstances in which, you know, his views became, very obvious. For example, if you take Zimbabwe, a country that, we did visit and we did meet with Mugabe, and he certainly, having, had interactions and so on, you know, with Mugabe and with Mugabe's people when he was president. I mean, that was one clear case, I'm just telling you, when he did not see any real prospect based on his knowledge of Mugabe. Carter was very much, he would really, he would work very much on his assessments of individuals. Carter was much more, even though there were people involved with dealing with, you know, constitutional issues, you know, legislative, all of it, he was very much, I meet you and I get a sense of you, and then I try to establish a relationship, and do you, you know, are you, you know, person that I think I can, I could do business with, I can work with.
Right.
Now, it didn't always happen to be the case that his assessment coincided with the assessment of all those of us working with him. And I could, you know, I mentioned we get to talk about some of those cases in case in point, right? So if when you ask a question about how optimistic, and there was no one else, I mean, we had a conflict resolution program and the person who headed that up, and we had some human rights person, but you know, at the time that, and of course I had a colleague, Robert Pastor, who was sort of my equivalent dealing with Latin America as I was with Africa. But Bob Pastor had had a longer relationship with Carter. He had served in the Carter administration and then had come to Emory. But in terms of Africa, the voice, you know, with regard to democracy in Africa was mine. I was the person who was, you know, writing, convening meetings, op-ed pieces, interviews, and so on. So, and, you know, I never got any pullback from Carter. You know, I mean, if we tread on certain toes and, you know, and if people complained about, you know, then, you know, I would get some kind of a message indicating like, you know, there is, but I wasn't, you know, I was never stopped and I wasn't sort of, you know, silenced in that regard. But, you know, I was made aware when, you know, the discomfort being caused by, you know, people in particular countries. And certainly in the case of Ghana, there were certainly messages coming back because, you know, their anxiety. And I'll discuss later on a particular case in point when I actually had to, you know, respond to, you know, to Rawlings himself, you know, in a meeting that take place subsequently. So optimism, I mean, you're looking at it, right? I was the voice, and yeah, I was optimistic. I mean, yeah, I was clear, you know, over and over again, these regimes that we have there, they're just not representative of the people. You know, their claims to, you know, that they're going to do this, that, and the other, I thought the evidence, I mean, it's not like now, it's a little more ambiguous, you know, Ethiopian war, but clearly then, my sense was that, you know, these things have persisted for far too long, and people have, I believe, very strongly, people have an inherent right to elect the governments of their choice and hold them accountable, period. I mean, I don't make any distinction for anything. I think all people are entitled to that, so, and, you know, so I never wavered from that during my time there, or subsequently. Right?
Great.
All right?
Yeah, I have a couple questions about the 92 election, but I think...
All right, yeah, we're going to save that. Save that, because we need to really... that's a big thing. But all right, good. All right, good start. And